thank you very much. First, I'd like to thank Professor Lee for inviting me and setting up and organizing this very nice lecture series. I'm very happy to be here, along with my colleagues Melissa Bowerman and Zoltan Kovacic. As you can see from the screens, that the topic of my lecture this morning is, or my whole series of lectures, is construction grammar and typology. And so I'd like to start by giving you an overview of the lectures that I'll be presenting here. I hope that many of you will be able to attend most of the lectures. I know that people will be coming and going depending on your own schedules. I also appreciate the fact that you're all here at 8 o'clock in the morning. So I'm going to give you a brief outline of the lectures to give you some idea of where I'm going, because this whole sequence is a kind of integrated whole. So what is the basic topic of these lectures? The syntactic theory that's associated with cognitive linguistics is what's called construction grammar. This is a theory that in its modern form was first developed by Charles Fillmore at the University of California in Berkeley, and I will be describing the basics of it this morning. One particular aspect about construction grammar is that it's symbolic. So one way in which it differs from other grammatical theories or models of syntax is that it's actually not only about syntax, it's about syntax and semantics, form and meaning. Now, my contribution to construction grammar is basically to bring a typological perspective on constructions, because I believe that this provides important insights on the nature of form, meaning, and the symbolic relations you find in grammar. So the first five lectures in this series basically have a theme that you can summarize as syntax is simpler than you think. One of the things that many of you may know about many syntactic theories that we have that are presented these days is that some of them are extremely complicated in terms of the syntactic structures they propose for the analysis of particular sentences in any language. And the main thrust of my own argument is, in fact, this is not the best way to go. In fact, the relationship is very simple. That is, the structure of the syntactic structures of sentences is actually extremely simple. So this morning I'll be talking about the basics of construction grammar. Pretty much everything that I'll tell you this morning you can find is shared with other approaches to construction grammar, such as those by Fillmore and Kay at Berkeley, George Lakoff also at Berkeley, Adele Goldberg at Princeton, as well as my own work on radical construction grammar. Then this afternoon, in the lecture I give this afternoon, I will talk about the role of syntactic categories in constructions and radical construction grammar. This is probably the most distinctive characteristic of this approach to construction grammar. While it's compatible with other kinds of construction grammar, it really is rather different. And so I will spend some time this afternoon defending it and showing you how I would respond to various criticisms that have been made. Tomorrow morning, I will use as a case study an example of the issue of parts of speech in Chinese. Obviously, I'm doing this because I'm here in Beijing. However, I will actually be using mostly evidence from a paper by Elaine Francis and Stephen Matthews on Cantonese. So most of what I'll be talking about is in Cantonese, but for many of the aspects of the structure of Cantonese that they discuss, it's also true of Mandarin, to the best of my knowledge. On Saturday afternoon, I'll be moving on to another topic having to do with the internal structure of constructions, of the syntactic structure of constructions. And this is an argument which also continues the theme that syntax is simpler than you think. It says that there's actually very little internal structure to the analysis of constructions in construction grammar. It doesn't need to be any more And in fact, it's a bad idea to have additional structure. And then lastly, on Sunday morning, I'll be talking about the syntactic space of constructions. The point here is that when we talk about constructions and we think of things like English passive or other kinds of constructions, some linguists, including some construction grammarians, have proposed that we can talk about a universal passive construction that can be described in different languages, or be described as occurring in different languages. And my argument here will be that, in fact, that's not the case. Just like with syntactic categories that I'll talk about this afternoon, grammatical constructions are language-specific, although we can talk about their syntactic properties and compare them from one language to the next. We just can't assume they're going to be identical. Now, the second half of my lectures will be covering what looks like a variety of themes: meaning, form, verbalization, and evolution. But in fact, they're all interrelated. They all touch on another kind of basic principle accepted by many construction grammarians, and this is what we call in cognitive linguistics the usage-based model. So I will be talking about how the usage-based model can be adapted by taking a perspective of verbalization, that is, how speakers take a particular experience they want to communicate to the listener and actually express that experience using the grammar of their language. This perspective gives you, again, that's probably the most interesting thing to me. It gives you, a very much of a novel view of how to look at meaning and the relationship between meaning and form. It also touches on the model of language change that was referred to in the introduction. So the first lecture, which is Sunday afternoon, so still here at Beihang University, I will be talking about grammar and the verbalization of experience. Using a model that was originally proposed by Wallace Chafe, I'll be elaborating that model and arguing that this model of verbalization actually allows us to talk about what kinds of constructions you do find in the world's languages. And then there's going to be a series of sort of the heart of the second half of my presentation has to do with a particular way of looking at the relationship between form and meaning, and in particular conceptual categories that I've been working on for a while. It started a long time ago, actually, but it is partly in the book I wrote on radical construction grammar. However, much of what I'll be presenting is based on research I've done since then. So on the first talk, and these are the lectures that are being held at other universities here in Beijing, I'll be talking about typological universals and the semantic map model. The semantic map model is this basic idea about how to represent conceptual structure or relationships between conceptual structures in typology. And once I introduce that, I'll use that to bring insights, I hope, into various aspects of the representation of meaning and form in cognitive linguistics. So Tuesday afternoon, these two talks here on Tuesday are actually very closely related to each other. We'll be talking about semantic maps and a statistical technique called multidimensional scaling, which allows us to essentially analyze very complex data that you collect in cross-linguistic comparison on the nature of categories. And it leads to some very interesting conclusions, I think, about the nature of grammatical categories and conceptual categories. And on Wednesday morning, I will be essentially drawing those conclusions, looking at a model which I call exemplar semantics, and how that allows us to rethink the relationship between form and meaning in language. And there are aspects of exemplar semantics, this kind of usage-based approach, a certain kind of usage-based approach, that leads you to the kind of evolutionary model which represents another strand of my research. Okay, so that's the overview. You can see that the lectures kind of fall into two halves. The first half is either based on or built on the work I did in the book on radical construction grammar. It's basically an outline of that approach. And then the second half draws some consequences based on research I've done since I published that book. Okay, so this morning I'm going to talk about basics of construction grammar. And this is, as I said, this is material that are concepts that you can find shared across different approaches to construction grammar. It has its roots in this classic work by Fillmore from the late 1980s and also by other linguists who do not call themselves construction grammarians who worked at the same time or in parallel. By the way, for those of you who are following the handouts in the slides in your handout packet, the overview I just gave you is not there in the packet, as you have surely all noticed. And now I start with what's in the packet. I've made a few minor changes to the slides, mainly just correction of errors and things like that. So basically what's up here is what you have in your packet. So what's an overview of constructions and construction grammar? I'm going to start by looking at the basic organization of linguistic knowledge that non-construction grammarians assume people have in their heads. There's some kind of mental representation of grammatical knowledge. Then the model that's quite widespread is obviously associated with generative grammar, but also with a number of its offshoots, including theories like lexical functional grammar, head-driven phrase structure grammar, these non-transformational theories, and also with Ray Jackendoff's recent work, where he has now stopped being a Chomskyan generative grammarian and is developing a different theory. So the model that they all have is the componential model, which I will describe on the next slide. And construction grammar is actually very different. And if there's any one thing I would say that makes construction grammar distinctive, it's the way that it essentially abandons this componential model that the other syntactic theories that are around use. However, I don't want to overstate the differences between construction grammar and the componential models. At least the way componential models are actually set up, they actually do share some properties with construction grammars. There's some sense in which construction grammar takes certain qualifications of the componential model and takes them to their logical conclusion. So what does the componential model look like? You may have seen these things if you've taken introductory courses in formal syntax. You have different components, such as the phonological component, the syntactic component, and the semantic component. And these different components are all kind of self-contained. That is, you study phonology in the phonological component. You examine syntax in the syntactic component. You examine semantics in the semantic component. And in fact, as all of you know, I think this is probably, I wouldn't be surprised if this is true here in China, as well as in the United States and Western Europe and in Australia. The way that we teach linguistics in university is based on the componential model. You take a class in phonology, you take another class in phonetics, you take another class in syntax, you take another class in semantics, and so on, and then when you're done, you've become a linguist, a specialist in linguistics. Now, there's one exception that all the advocates of the componential model are willing to acknowledge, and that is that the lexicon actually combines features from all of these different models, or these different components. So, for example, if you have a word like take, a verb, it has a phonological form, take. It has syntactic characteristics, the fact that it combines with a subject and an object and maybe some kind of oblique phrases. And it has a semantics, which we could represent in whatever way we want. I'm not so concerned with that right now. So that is the way, in the traditional componential model, you link the different components. Because obviously, every time you speak, you're producing sounds. Those sounds form words that are organized into syntactic structures and utterances, and there's a meaning that the speaker is trying to convey. But that turns out not to be enough, because you have all sorts of syntactic structures that, of course, I would call constructions. And these syntactic structures systematically convey certain meanings. You know, you use an intransitive construction if you want to express one kind of meaning, and a transitive construction if you want to express another kind of meaning. And so what are the systematic relations in meaning? They can't just be captured only by the words in the sentence and whatever syntactic traits you attribute to them. You have to have some kind of rules that relate, say, the syntactic structure to the semantic structure. Nowadays, these rules are called linking rules. Sometimes they're called interface rules. Sometimes they're called realization rules, like the realization of meaning in syntactic form. Well, these rules essentially say that there are other ways in which we have to link these separate components than just the lexicon. So there's some sense in which these components are not as self-contained or independent or autonomous from each other than you might think. So this next slide just summarizes the main points I made from the diagram, which is that each qualitatively different type of grammatical structure is independent. So this is the idea that you look at phonology and you don't have to worry about syntax. You look at syntax, you don't have to worry about phonology, and you don't have to worry about semantics. And then you can look at semantics, and you don't have to worry about syntax, or let alone phonology. So in particular, there's the claim that if you want to understand the nature of language, the best thing to do is to isolate phonology from syntax, isolate syntax from semantics, look at them by themselves, and you will find general principles or universal properties of each type of linguistic structure. Now, as I said, the lexicon links together information in each component, but the assumption is that the lexicon is arbitrary. So there's nothing terribly interesting about the fact that the English word take has the phonological structure it does, and has the meaning that it does, and has the syntactic behavior that it does. Nevertheless, as I already mentioned in the diagram, linguists who use the componential model require linking rules, interface rules, or realization rules, such as rules of semantic interpretation or syntactic realization. So in fact, not everything that's interesting about syntax and semantics can be done by ignoring the other. So in fact, that second bullet point here, let's see, here is actually not entirely true. Not all the important regularities are self-contained. Now, constructions as a notion is found in the traditional grammatical analysis in Western linguistics, or Western grammatical tradition. So I just picked arbitrarily an example from a 19th century grammar of Latin. So many grammars, of course, were written in the 19th century, long before the advent of structuralism and generative grammar and all these other 20th century syntactic theories. So what did they do when they were faced with the kinds of facts of languages that we are interested in? Well, they actually divided syntactic structures into categories that they called constructions. So for instance, this particular grammar isolates a particular kind of construction that they call a correlative comparative sentence or construction. And I'll give you an example from this particular grammar book of this kind of construction. Translation is, they complain of ambition as they do of a sweetheart. Can't remember the source. So what is a construction in the traditional Western grammar? It's a complex syntactic structure. So if you look at the sentence, you have these things translated here, the so word and the as word. These are what are called correlative conjunctions. And of course, that has the correlative conjunctions combine two different phrases here. There's a particular meaning associated with a construction. It's encapsulated in the name of the construction, that it involves comparison. So you're comparing they're complaining about ambition and they complain about a sweetheart. And the construction has particular grammatical and semantic constraints. So there's only a subset of conjunctions that can be used in this kind of construction. There are limits on the mood of the clause, so the grammatical category of Latin. And of course, there are specialized meanings for these different conjunctions and other things that characterize this construction. So that's what you find if you go to the sort of pre-construction grammar notion of a construction in the Western grammatical tradition. I'm sorry, I don't know if there's anything equivalent in the Chinese grammatical tradition. Now, this notion of construction, this traditional notion, is denied by Chomsky, and he's been fairly consistent about this view, at least in the last 20 years, well, 30 years, actually. And so I have two quotations here on the screen in your book about that. So one is from his lectures on government and binding from 30 years ago, and he says, "A central element in the work discussed here, as in recent work from which it evolves, is the effort to decompose such processes as passive, relativization, etc., into more fundamental abstract features." So he calls these processes passive and relativization because in generative grammar these constructions are created through a transformational rule or set of rules, but we think of them more as constructions, whatever is the output of those rules. In more recent work from the Minimalist Program, 1993, Chomsky describes universal grammar and says it provides a fixed system of principles and a finite array of finitely valued parameters. The language particular rules reduce the choice of values for these parameters. The notion of grammatical construction is eliminated, and with it, construction particular rules. Well, for him, a construction particular rule is like the rule that creates relative clauses. So in both of these cases, he's arguing that you don't need constructions. You can come up with something more abstract, and then you don't need constructions anymore. Now, the main challenge to this work is from what are called idioms in the Western grammatical tradition. And this is the starting point for the research by Fillmore and Kay and O'Connor in a great paper from 1988, which I all recommend to all of you. And there's another paper from linguists actually in a different grammatical tradition, Nunberg, Sog, and Wasso, also talking about idioms, and they make some important points and very insightful points as well, some of which I'll talk about right now and others I will talk about in lecture 4. So one point they make is that you have what are called idioms in English, things like pull strings. Pull strings means to use influence in order to obtain something you want, like a job. And they describe these as idiomatically combining expressions. That's their term for it. And the crucial thing, that point that they make, is that pull plus strings is compositional. It's just not predictable from abstract rules. So in other words, we need a construction-specific rule. If we take a very specific view of construction, so that pull strings is by itself an idiomatic construction. The quotation they have is that by convention, so convention of English, strings and pull strings can be used metaphorically to refer to personal connections when it is the object of pull, and pull can be used metaphorically to refer to exploitation or exertion when its object is strings. So in other words, you can say what pull means in this idiom, and you can say what strings means in this idiom. It just doesn't, the words don't mean the same thing that they do elsewhere, like, you know, pulling a cart or using strings to tie a package. So here's a constructional representation, and I'm going to be using variations of this in the rest of today's, this morning's lecture. So we can look at pull strings, and I've done this in the componential model, so everything is color-coded by this, by the way. So the blue here, at least it's blue on my screen, represents the syntactic structure. Red here represents those meanings that you find only in this combination. So that's the semantic structure of this construction. And I've described it in terms of these components by looking at you can see these horizontal boxes that represent the semantic structure and the syntactic structure. And then you have, so to speak, linking rules. That was what Nunberg, Sog, and Washoe described in that quotation, that pull means exploit in combination with strings, and strings means connections in combination with pull. Now, the insight that Fillmore, Kay, and O'Connor presented is that some of these so-called idioms are actually schematic. They aren't just concrete words like pull plus strings. They're more schematic syntactic categories that are combined in special ways and have their own rules about their syntax and semantics, and maybe even about the phonology and the pragmatics. So the classic example they have is X let alone Y, the let alone construction, which was the focus of analysis of this paper. There are two examples of that at the bottom of the slide, so both from their paper. Max won't eat shrimp, let alone squid. And what that means, if you're not familiar with the construction, is two things. One is that Max won't eat shrimp. And the second is that I am saying that the fact that Max eats shrimp is actually pretty significant. And certainly, he's even less adventurous in food than somebody who eats squid would be. The second sentence shows that you can have this kind of parallelism within these two clauses where you have two elements being contrasted. So Max won't touch the shrimp, let alone clean the squid. So once again, we're comparing touching the shrimp to cleaning the squid. And saying that Max won't do the first thing, and that's, you know, a pretty strong statement, since it's more surprising than if he didn't want to clean the squid. So let me go back, sorry. It's not going back far enough. One point they make here, which I have on the second bullet point on this slide, is that the syntactic and semantic and other details about the let alone construction, you know, contrary to Chomsky's claim, cannot be derived from more general facts about English conjunctions, English focus constructions, represented by the accent on shrimp and squid, or particularly focus constructions with multiple paired foci, so these are paired foci, touch and clean. Or with what are called negative polarity items, because this let alone construction always occurs with a negative clause context. Even though its properties cannot be predicted from these more general grammatical categories and constructions of English, the let alone construction still is quite systematic in terms of its semantic interpretation. So first, you have to have two propositions you're comparing. So Max does not eat shrimp, Max does not eat squid. They're in what he calls the same scalar model. So there has to be some way that you and I can say that Max not eating shrimp is a more informative or surprising statement than Max does not eat squid. The propositions must have the same polarity, so they must both be negative in this case. And then the first conjunct, this is Max not eating shrimp, is the more informative proposition in the scale. And so as I mentioned before, at least from an American cultural perspective, not eating shrimp is more informative than not eating squid. There are lots of people who don't eat squid, and there's fewer people around that don't eat shrimp. And then you can generalize this to the example like Max won't touch the shrimp, let alone clean the squid. So you can set this up in a way that you can determine the semantic interpretation looking at those combined foci. So that paper was very important because it showed that there is a lot of regularity in the let alone construction. It could not be predicted from general grammatical principles, as Chomsky claimed, and yet it was regular and systematic, and therefore most linguists interested in linguistic theory would say that you need to be able to explain it. So you can't just ignore it and pretend, oh, it's some arbitrary fact like pull strings. And Nunberg, Sog, and Washoe showed that even pull strings is systematic within its own extremely narrow domain, namely pull combined with strings and strings combined with pull. But they were not the first to observe this fact. It's just that other linguists did not draw the conclusions that Fillmore et al. Did, that we really need to think about the nature of grammar and syntactic structure because of these facts. So, for example, Ellen Prince, who sadly just passed away a couple of weeks ago, American linguist who did much work on pragmatics, she focused her attention on looking at the pragmatic structure of particular English constructions, such as the so-called cleft constructions. These are two examples that she collected and published in this paper from 1978. So we're talking about something done over 30 years ago. So you can see the two examples. It is against pardoning these, as that many protest. And what you are saying is that the president was involved. So that what you are saying is the WH cleft. I'm not going to go into detail here. My main point is just to show that there are antecedents to construction grammar, at least among American and English speaking linguists. So Prince showed that there are certain differences between these two different kinds of cleft constructions, both syntactically, that's what the first bullet point tells you. They allow different kinds of units, adverbs and prepositional phrases for WH clefts, verb phrases or sentences with it clefts. In WH clefts, the clefts also differ in their pragmatics. So in WH clefts, the subordinate clause information is in the hearer's consciousness already, but the it cleft has two subsenses, which I won't go into now, but they're different from the WH cleft. So these two cleft constructions differ in both their syntax and their semantics, but they're quite systematic in that if you find such clefts in naturally occurring discourse, you can make some conclusions about their grammatical behavior and their semantic interpretation. Another kind of construction, a great paper by Anna Wierzbicka, Australian linguist, comparing constructions in English that have plus some kind of verb form. As you can see from the example at the beginning, which is taken from the title of her paper, you can have a drink in English, but you can't have an eat. And so she wanted to explore why this was the case. So first she argued that the expression that comes after the indefinite article, is actually not a noun, but a verb, a kind of bare verb infinitival form. So it's not your ordinary noun to begin with. So you can't infer that just because it comes after the indefinite article, it's a noun in the same sense that other phrases with indefinite articles have nouns. More generally, she said that have a V represents an action as limited in time, but not punctual in the aspectual sense, not occurring at a point in time. In fact, it's much more complicated than that, and that's what a lot of these people working on constructions tend to discover, is that you think there's just one construction, like have a verb, but in fact, Wierzbicka identified 10 subsenses of have a verb. One example is what she calls aimless, objectless action, which could cause one to feel good, and she points out that it's restricted with verbs that have a certain kind of semantic properties, that they're intransitive, spectrally they're durative and atelic. So you can say have a walk, have a swim, have a run, have a jog, have a lie down, but you can't say in this meaning have a work or have a play, because those verbs do not fit the description. Lakoff, another famous example, this is more your prototypical cognitive linguist doing this kind of research. At about the same time as Fillmore, his colleague, was working on the let alone construction, he published a detailed analysis of their constructions. He again took what started out as one construction and ended up with 15, 11 types of what he called deictic their constructions, and 4 subsenses of what he called the existential their construction. I've given you some examples of the deictic constructions at the top and the existential constructions at the bottom. And in a very long appendix to his 1987 book, he shows that each construction has distinctive syntactic and semantic properties. Again, the details aren't there. My main point is here to show you that linguists working in different grammatical traditions, like Ellen Prince, Anna Wierzbicka, George Lakoff, and also Ray Jackendoff, have all proposed that we have to acknowledge the existence of constructions, patterns of grammatical structure that are systematic, have systematic syntactic properties and semantic properties. You can't just derive them from abstract general principles of syntax. So the Jackendoff example is more recent. Examples include what he calls this the time away construction. It's a particular use of away, but it's actually away in a special combination. So he points out that in a sentence like, Bill slept the afternoon away, sleep is an intransitive verb, but it takes what looks like a direct object, the afternoon. Fred drank the night away with a bottle of Jack Daniels. So you get this construction with transitive verbs like drink, but you can't use the transitive object. You have to express the transitive object as a with phrase, so with a bottle of Jack Daniels. Semantically, these are durative expressions, so they talk about some event that takes place over time. But they have an additional constraint that the subject must be volitional, like an agent, and the verb describes an activity. The particular particle away, here's something that's quite striking, is that if you look at other constructions in English that use the particle away, it has an atelic meaning, an unbounded ongoing process. But in this particular construction, it describes a bounded process, bounded by the time interval described by this direct object, the afternoon or the night. So this is definitely a property of the construction that cannot be predicted from other uses of away. So now, what some linguists, not Fillmore et al., but some of the other linguists, have proposed what we might call an enhanced componential model. So we're back to this original slide. You have our autonomous components here. You allow the lexicon to cross these components. But now we allow for constructions of this type I just described. So constructions also have form and meaning, and they also have linking rules, but we aren't going to get rid of their componential model yet, or at least that's the view of many linguists who work in this area. So many syntacticians nowadays acknowledge that we have to account for constructions in this sense, but they're still unwilling to get rid of the componential model. But what constructions show us is that these different components are not so self-contained, and there are many important regularities that cannot be captured by looking at just syntax, just semantics, or just phonology. And general linking rules are not going to do it for you, because the rules of a semantic interpretation, the syntactic constraints, are particular to individual constructions, like the meaning of the word away that we just saw. Now, Fillmore et al. And others have pointed out that constructions, not just if we propose that we need constructions for analyzing grammatical structures, then suddenly this little thing we added to the componential model is actually better than the componential model in describing any kind of syntactic or grammatical or lexical structure. So the way to look at this is to think about constructions not in the traditional grammatical sense, but in a much broader sense as any kind of pairing and form and meaning. And these pairings of form and meaning, which include the lexicon, vary in certain essential parameters. And the two parameters we're going to look at are complexity, whether there's more than one or just one formal element, and schematicity, whether we're talking about some general category defined by the construction or a specific word like pull and pull strings or away in the time away construction. So if you're talking about what your traditional grammarian calls syntax, what you're looking at are constructions that are complex. They consist of more than one element. And they're also schematic. Those elements cover classes of words like ones we'll call adjective and noun, for now at least. many linguists who had to, in describing the syntactic behavior of lexical items like verbs like take, called these subcategorization frames. These things go under new names nowadays. But basically, a subcategorization frame consists of a schematic, a complex construction, so it describes something that has a subject and an object, for example, but the verb itself is substantive. It's a particular verb, not the general category of transitive verb. Idioms like pull string, these are complex but substantive. Each individual word is specified, and it only has the meaning if those two words are combined in the right way. So those are the kinds of idiomatically combining expressions that Nunberg, Sog, and Wasso talked about. But you can go even further than that. We can move away from things that we traditionally call syntax into morphology. So in morphology, we can talk about something which is complex and morphologically bound. So we have a schematic category noun which combines with an inflection for plurality in English. And that too is a construction in this sense. It's a pairing of form and meaning. It just happens to be that the morphemes are bound instead of free. And they may be schematic or they may be substantive. We can even talk about atomic units. We could talk about syntactic categories in the traditional sense. They're atomic, they're not complex, it's just one element. But these are schematic. A syntactic category covers a large class of words. Of course, I'll be talking a lot more about those later. And finally, words, the lexicon, can also be described as kind of very special kinds of constructions. They are atomic, it's just one word, but they're also substantive, they're not schematic at all. So you have words like after and wilderness. So in other words, a word like after and wilderness is a construction just as much as the attributive adjective construction or the passive construction is a construction in this generalized sense. And these points were all made by Fillmore, Kay, and O'Connor in their classic 1988 paper. So that's another respect in which I think of this paper as being very far-sighted. And the first major publication on construction grammar really laid out all of the most important principles behind that. The principle here is that if you allow constructions into your model of grammatical analysis, then you really kind of have to, or you allow, you can now describe all kinds of grammatical structures in the same way. It's a pairing of form and meaning that can be complex or atomic, can be fully schematic, partially schematic, or fully substantive. So the constructional model now looks different. We don't have components anymore. Instead, we have constructions, including the lexicon as a special class of constructions. And each construction now has phonological properties, syntactic properties, and semantic properties. So the point I've just made is that the constructional model provides a uniform representation of all grammatical structure. The constructional model retains distinctions between different types of grammatical information. So when you put them all together, you can still distinguish between properties of a construction's form and properties of a construction's function in particular. The constructional model now has to capture those regularities that used to be captured within components, and it does this by taxonomic relations between constructions. So for example, if you have a regular grammatical expression like tie strings, and then you have idiomatic constructions like pull strings or kick the bucket, well, they all have in common that you have a verb form followed by a direct object. And the way we capture the fact that they all have this in common is that we have a superordinate or schematic construction, the verb phrase construction, that captures this fact. All these constructions share this property in common. We'll see this is not the only way to capture generalizations, but the point here is that this is one way in which you do this in construction grammar. Constructions, although I'm going to say in my lectures that constructions are pretty simple, they still have internal structure. So if we look at a construction, we can see that a very important distinction we have to make are the properties of a construction's form, syntactic, morphological, and phonological properties, and properties of a construction's function or meaning, so semantic properties, pragmatic properties, and discourse properties. And crucially, that these things are paired. So constructions are what Laniker calls symbolic units, pairings of form and meaning. Now let's compare how form and function are done in the componential model to how it's done in the construction grammar model. I've used labels here that obviously don't have much to do with cognitive linguistic approaches to grammar, traditional generative approaches, so we have phrases like noun phrase and verb phrase, and then we have some kind of pseudo-logical representation of meaning like predicate and argument, quantifier, and so on. So in the componential model, these kinds of structures would be separated from those kind of structures and syntactic and semantic components. Then you have to create linking rules that tell you that you interpret the intransitive clause in terms of a predicate applied to an argument, quantifier modifying a noun as quantification. And that's the grammar. In the constructional model, you can see we still have the same units, but now they're paired as individual constructions linked to their meanings. I'll go kind of quickly over this. It sort of repeats kind of things I've said before. So you have a typical generative representation. The first thing to notice is that it's only syntactic structure. The second is the kind of relatively complex structure even here. This kind of box notation represents a constructional model, and here the thing to see is that you have some kind of description of the construction's form and of its meaning for a simple intransitive sentence like Heather sings. Again, syntactic structure, semantic structure, and the construction as a whole is the pairing of those two. Now I'd like to introduce some terminology. Some of this terminology is mine, some of this is Fillmore and Kay's, so that we can talk about these basic parts of a construction in the rest of the lectures. So parts of the syntactic form of a construction we'll call elements. Parts of the semantic form of a semantic part of the construction, the meaning, we'll call components. So we have elements for syntax, components for semantics. And then the term unit, which is actually from Laniker, for the pairing of any particular pairing of form and meaning. You can also have an exploded diagram of a construction. This is very similar to what you find in Laniker's cognitive grammar. So instead of having the boxes, Heather and thing inside the box which represents their combination, we split it out, and then we can now describe the relationships between each individual element and the construction as a whole, and between the two elements, and the same down here for the components. That turns out to be a very important distinction. This terminology was introduced by Fillmore and Kay, and this is the distinction between roles and relations. So a role is what an element does, that is the part to the whole construction. So you can say that Heather is the subject in the intransitive construction. A relation is a relation between two different elements in a single construction. So it's a relationship between two parts of the construction. And that's a sense in which we say Heather is the subject of the verb sings. Now you will notice, of course, that grammarians use the same term, subject, to describe a role and a relation. This is not always the case. In this particular example, it is true. And I put this example in here to essentially warn you that some grammatical terminology is ambiguous in this sense, that it describes both a role and a relation. And you have to ask yourself, when you're looking at a particular description of a grammatical construction, is the author talking about a role or about a relation? And as we'll see, this will turn out to be very important, because I will say that we should not be talking about relations at all, only roles. Then what is this notion of syntactic relation, this relation between parts? People have sometimes asked me about this question because when you talk to your sort of more generative-oriented syntactician or some European syntacticians, you'll see that they actually don't talk about syntactic relations. They talk about several different kinds of things, and I want to clarify that here. So the first is they talk about what grammatical properties actually identify a syntactic relation. So in a sentence like, she loves him, how do we know that she is the subject of love and him is the object of love? Well, for she, we can look at the case marking, has a special pronoun form in English. We can also look at the verb, and you can see the verb has indexation, which is also called agreement, third singular form. And you can also look at the word order. The subject occurs before the verb in English in declarative sentences. So that's one thing you can talk about. Another thing you can talk about with syntactic relations is how do you represent them? So there's been this long debate, several decades long, in Western syntactic analyses about whether this is a better way of expressing the relationships in terms of what's called constituent structure, or this is the better way, some kind of functions or dependencies, or pick your favorite one. I don't particularly care because I'm going to be getting rid of these anyway. So instead, I'm just going to talk about the syntactic relation in the abstract. So the relationship between she and loves is indicated by this dotted arrow here between she and loves in this diagram. And as I said, I'm not particularly concerned whether we represent that relation in terms of constituency or dependency. And right now, if we're looking at this in terms of syntactic structure, I'm not yet concerned about how this is expressed with the special forms of pronouns, with agreement on the verb or word order. We will come back to that. However, you can allow for constructions to be nested. So if you have a sentence in English like, that blonde girl is my niece, that's the equational construction, but the parts of the equational construction are themselves constructions. So you have an equational subject which has the form with a demonstrative followed by an adjective and ending with a noun, and then an equational complement which has a similar structure. So you have the equational subject and complement constructions embedded inside the equational construction as a whole, as well as, of course, the equational verb to be. Constructions can form taxonomies, and one of the things you can say here is that with another construction discussed by Fillmore, Kay, and O'Connor, what they called the X or the Y, a comparative correlative construction in their terms, you have a general construction which can be used for lots of different words, but then you also have specialized constructions. So there's an idiom in English called the bigger they come, the harder they fall. Basically, people who end up being prouder or more powerful, if they fall, tend to fall farther, so to speak. So that's actually in the form of the X or the Y construction. So we'll call the more general one a schema. This is following work by Bybee and Lanaker and so on. And the more specific construction is an instance. So then you can develop fancy taxonomies of multiple levels to try to capture the relationships and generalizations about the syntactic structure of English, for example. And we'll come back to this in later lectures. So constructions may have multiple parents. This is another important thing. If you're talking about a particular sentence like, I didn't sleep, if you look at the way English forms sentences, clauses, you can talk relatively independently about how English combines a verb or predicate with its arguments, subject and object and oblique, from how a verb expresses negation. And so we can represent this, and construction grammarians do this all the time, in terms of a particular sentence like, I didn't sleep, inheriting some grammatical properties from one construction, the construction for intransitive verbs, and some grammatical properties from another construction, the construction that describes how we form declarative negative sentences in English. You combine the two and you get, I didn't sleep. So to conclude this brief introduction, construction grammar represents a different organization of grammatical knowledge than in componential models. Construction grammar provides a uniform representation of grammatical structure. This is the syntax lexicon continuum. Some construction grammarians use the term constructicon to describe this. And then construction grammar organizes constructions into taxonomies in order to capture grammatical generalizations. So I said at the beginning of the lecture there are certain things that all construction grammar theories have in common. It's basically these three points that I've presented here on the concluding slide. So that's the end of what I have to say about constructions this morning. It's a general introduction. If you come back this afternoon, I will start talking about some more specific things about how radical construction grammar differs from the kind of generic view of construction grammar that I presented here this morning. So thank you very much.